Today at Reader's Corner, A.J. Bamey, author of The Arsenal of Democracy, FDR, Detroit, and an Epic Quest to Arm an America at War. I'm Bob Kustra. Welcome to Reader's Corner. When Germany invaded its European neighbors in 1940, the United States was far from prepared. America's military resources had been all but drained by the Great Depression. The U.S. Army was smaller than that of Belgium's, a nation that could fit inside Maryland. In at least one instance, a U.S. general was forced to order tank replacement parts from a Sears and Roebuck catalog because the military couldn't provide the items itself. Yet in May of 1940, after weeks of reports of Nazi warplanes sweeping over Belgium, Luxembourg, Holland, and parts of France, President Franklin Roosevelt stood before Congress with an ambitious proposal. He asked for more than $1 billion for the military, including a program to produce 50,000 military and naval planes. This war, Roosevelt knew, had to be won in the skies. One city took up Roosevelt's Democratic call to arms with gusto. Detroit became known as the Arsenal of Democracy, as the nation's leading car manufacturers turned their talents to realizing Roosevelt's dream. And one family-owned company in particular, the Ford Motor Company, saw Roosevelt's high-flying stakes and raised them, vowing to produce one bomber an hour or 400 bombers a month to help with the war effort. Today's guest, A.J. Bamey, tells the story of the Ford family at this pivotal moment in history in his book, The Arsenal of Democracy, FDR, Detroit, and an Epic Quest to Arm an America at War. It's now out in paperback, and today we're featuring an encore edition of our interview with Mr. Bamey. He joins us by phone for this interview. A.J. Bamey, welcome to Reader's Corner.
I'm so happy to be here. Thank you very much for having me.
Well, let's start with Detroit, A.J. Why was Detroit so uniquely positioned to be the car manufacturing town at the turn of the century, which is really the beginning of this story?
Well, the whole idea, the government had this idea that this was going to be an industrialized war and that it was going to be really a contest of mass production. And if it was going to be a contest of mass production, tanks, airplanes, jeeps, field kitchens, parachutes, canteens, everything had to be mass produced. So if that was going to be the case, if it was going to be a war of mass production, who could outproduce the United States of America's automobile industry? So that's really what the story, what the book is about. It's about how FDR leaned on the American automobile industry based in Detroit to win the war.
Now, the Ford family comes into play here, obviously, since this is about also the Ford Motor Company. Tell us a little bit about the Ford family, starting perhaps with Henry and his relationship with Edsel, and then leading on up to the war.
I wanted the book to be, there's been a whole bunch of books written about, you know, all angles of the war. I wanted this book to be something different. I wanted it to be a portrait of a family and the story of Henry and his son, Edsel. It's a very tragic, sad story. And by telling their story, I can illuminate everything that happened during the war and everything happened with the automobile industry. Now, Henry Ford, at the beginning of the war, was still probably the most famous American in the world. He represented Americanism. At the same time, he was an extremely controversial character. He was a known anti-Semite, and he was also the most vocal anti-war activist at the time. His son, Edsel, was very different. They had a father-son sort of problem, like happens in many families. They were from two different generations, and they had a very hard time understanding each other, but they loved each other desperately. And I think Edsel Ford spent a lifetime trying to live up to his father's expectations, and I think he was a brilliant man. I think he was very misunderstood, and by the time the war started, he was dying of what we think was probably cancer or some sort of stomach ailment. It's a little unclear what exactly killed him, but he was dying at the beginning of the war, and he saw the war as one last chance to sort of achieve honor before his death, and so he launched this great industrial project called Willow Run, which would be the largest airplane factory in the world, the largest factory of any kind in the world under one roof, to make a single bomber an hour, the biggest bomber of them all at the time, the B-24. Now, Edsel did not live to see his dream realized. He died in 1943, and everything that happened after it is quite heroic.
Well, let's go back to the beginning as far as Edsel is concerned. First of all, I have to admit, I really never followed the Ford Motor Company in Detroit getting into the airplane business. And so that was itself a great awakening for me to read the role that Edsel played. Take us back to Edsel's role in getting into the airplane business to begin with.
Actually, as a teenager with some buddies, he built an airplane. I think it was 3 or 4 years after the Wright brothers flew their plane. He was fascinated with airplanes as a child, and when he got a little older, he became at a very young age president of Ford Motor Company, which was the most famous company in the world. And he was very much overshadowed by his dad, but he had this idea. He wanted to get into aviation, and he thought if he could do for the airplane, mass produce airplanes, be the first to mass produce airplanes in the 1920s, if he could do that for aviation, he could live up to his legacy. He could do for airplanes what his dad did for cars. That was his goal. For a while in the 1920s, Ford Motor Company, because of Edsel, was the largest airplane manufacturer in the country. Now, the Great Depression and some other things basically destroyed that dream. And so Ford was out of aviation, and Edsel was, sort of left adrift until the war, and suddenly America needed airplanes. The military needed airplanes. And so Edsel stepped in, and that's really at the heart of this book.
Let's talk a little bit about the workers, about the Ford Motor Company and those who staffed it, so to speak. First of all, of course, Henry Ford did some things that was very popular with workers, and I assume it was based on the fact that he thought he could get more out of workers if he treated them more decently. And then what Henry Ford wasn't able to do, the Wagner Act was able to do. So help us follow the culture of Henry Ford's approach to workers, how he treated them, a number of hours they worked, and then, of course, the Wagner Act.
Early on, Henry Ford had this idea that the machine would be, and these are his words, I'm quoting him, the machine is the new Messiah. So he had this idea that machines could do for the world and for people, basically what the church was going to do, should do. It was going to change everybody's life for the better. It was going to take people who, worked for bad wages, and he was going to pay them well, and then they were going to work hard, and because they were paid well, they would work hard, and their work would be of high quality, and they would earn enough money to buy the thing that they were making, a Model T. And this happened for hundreds of thousands of people in his assembly plants and factories. Now, when the Wagner Act came around in 1935, FDR basically, said, okay, unions have the right to organize, laborers have the right to organize, and that put an unprecedented amount of power in the American workers' hands for the first time. And Henry didn't appreciate that. He didn't think that the government had any right to tell him, as an industrialist, what workers' rights in his factory should be. It wasn't the government's place. And this created a huge clash between labor and Henry Ford. So the automobile companies signed with the unions. They made the deals. It was the law in the late 1930s and 1937, and Henry Ford refused to. And so what happened was there was a riot, and there are pictures of the riot in the book, in the Arsenal of Democracy. And so leading up to the war, the factories became a very dark place. Henry Ford organized what was called the Service Department, which was the largest private police force in the country, and their job was to go and beat up anybody who was passing out union literature. I mean, that actually happened. It's insane. It's just crazy to think about today, but that's what happened.
So while Henry was busy making cars for folks here in the United States, he also had quite an investment in Germany. Help us understand what happens here as he moves over to Germany. And this is the 1930s, so right up until the time that Germany invades Poland, you've got the Ford Motor Company and I think General Motors as well playing key roles in Germany in building automobiles.
This is true. This is extremely controversial. I want to just speak slowly and make sure I choose my words carefully. And in the book, I explain basically during the Depression when Hitler took over, Germany had the strongest economy in Europe. It was the only economy. They had a labor shortage there because everybody was working under Hitler in the 1930s. And American companies were suffering during the Depression, and they saw an opportunity if they invested money, which they did. A lot of companies, not just Ford and General Motors, but ITT and Singer Sewing, and all of these companies invested a tremendous amount of money in Germany in the 1930s because they were short of earning profits there. However, Hitler forbade any of these American companies from taking any of those profits out of the country. So none of these industrialists anticipated the war, nor did they anticipate the evil of Hitler and the Gestapo and the whole regime. They didn't see that coming. And so here they had these huge investments in Nazi Germany, and they couldn't get their money out. They couldn't get their investment out, and Hitler started making demands of these American companies: give us raw materials, build this, build that. Can you build this engine? Can you do this, do that? And these companies were faced with losing everything. They saw that there was a chance that Hitler was just going to confiscate all of their factories and their companies, and they would be devastated. So they were stuck in this position, and as the situation got worse, Hitler made more demands. And so in the book, I talk about all of that, and I focus on Ford, not because Ford was any more guilty than any other company. In fact, they weren't. And I do not paint Henry Ford as a Nazi, as many did at the time, and many still do today. But it's just fascinating to see these industrialists that had to make these extraordinary decisions, and there was no way out of the situation.
I'm Bob Kustra, host of Reader's Corner, and I'm speaking with A.J. Bamey about his book, Arsenal of Democracy. The book tells the story of how the Ford Motor Company helped America gain control of the skies during World War II. Well, he was certainly unwitting when it comes to his accepting a major award. I think he was decorated by Hitler. Wasn't that the case?
Yes. Hitler's a brilliant propagandist. Basically, he gave out some awards to certain American businessmen, and one to Charles Lindbergh, who's also a major figure in the arsenal of democracy in my book. Lindbergh, Henry Ford, and some others received this cross from Hitler, and Hitler, you know, made sure that these awards were given some publicity. So Henry Ford was shown in the newspaper in 1938, I believe, with German officials having this swastika, you know, pinned to his suit at his 80th or 75th birthday, his 75th birthday party. Now, at the time, he had no idea. Henry Ford didn't understand, I think, what was happening. Meanwhile, this picture of him showed up in the newspaper, and there was this huge uproar. And Henry Ford, being the controversial figure he was, he said, "Hey, I don't support Hitler. I don't support hate." At the same time, he refused to give the award back. And I think what he was concerned with was that if he pissed off Hitler, he stood to, again, lose all his investments in Germany. They had invested millions and millions of dollars in their German operations. And again, in 1938, most Americans didn't believe there was going to be a war in 1938. They were very scared, and whether there were not there was going to be a war was the topic in the newspapers to talk about. But most people in America, according to Gallup polls, they still didn't believe there was going to be a war, and they certainly didn't believe that America was going to be involved.
Well, at that time, they were led by a president who wasn't so sure he wanted to go to war. So needless to say, that was the national climate then. I got a kick out of the fact that Eddie Cantor comes into this. There's probably not many people who even remember Eddie Cantor, but I do from my childhood when he was still a song and dance man or acting or whatever. And I think you point out in the book that Henry Ford had to deal with the Jewish community that just didn't understand why he would accept this award.
That's right. He was not a favorite of the Jews at the time, Henry Ford. And again, this is also this played into his relationship with his son, Edsel, who's the other sort of main character in the book, if you will, because Edsel was ahead of his time. And he was Henry hated Roosevelt because he thought Roosevelt was, you know, too powerful. And Roosevelt didn't have any right to meddle in American business. Edsel loved Roosevelt. They were friends. Edsel had every year for Roosevelt's birthday held a party to raise money for polio. Henry was a known anti-Semite. He was from a previous generation. Edsel had many friends who were Jews and wealthy Jews. And so, again, this played into this problem between father and son not seeing eye to eye.
So what was the state of the U.S. Army at the dawn of World War II? Let's get into this conversation about how we build up the force, so to speak.
Sure. Well, FDR saw early on, after Hitler invaded much of Europe, the degree to which in modern warfare that the airplane was going to play a major role. Tanks, jeeps, horses were a thing of the past. So they had to, you know, build an army. General George Marshall, who many of the listeners will know, is very famous for building up and organizing the modern army, turning it from just a few hundred thousand soldiers into over 7 million. Now, these soldiers needed guns. They needed the tools of modern warfare. And that's what, again, that's another major topic of this book, is how we realized that dream to build this mechanized army. And what I focus on is the obsession with bombers, because the bomber aircraft was really going to be the key weapon. And it was. So how were we going to build these bombers? Nobody had ever mass-produced bombers before. It had never been done. Again, that's where the Ford story comes in right there.
So describe Willow Run for us, the size of this large manufacturing facility.
In the book, I use a lot of photographs, and I use a lot of oral histories, and I'm able to put together in great detail what it looked like and sounded like and what it smelled like. I found diaries of the people who worked there. So I'm able to describe this factory in really vivid detail. So, you know, what it looked like when you walked in, and excerpts from diaries of people who worked there. And, of course, you know, Rosie the Riveter, the whole idea of Rosie the Riveter, she started as a woman named Rose Monroe. She was a riveter at Willow Run Bomber Plant. Huh. Interestingly, just recently, this bomber plant is still sitting there in Ypsilanti, Michigan, and most of it just leveled, a year and a half ago. And the most famous part of this plant is this huge area with these massive garage doors that would open and the bombers would roll out. And that part of the factory is still there, and it's being built into a museum right now. So if you're ever in Ypsilanti, Michigan, this is something you need to see.
How did Charles Lindbergh figure into this story of the Arsenal of Democracy?
Well, it's interesting. Lindbergh is endlessly fascinating. He's one of those characters that you write about. It's just so fun to write about him because he's just so interesting. There's so many facets about him, and he was such a figure of fascination at the time. Now, before the war, Lindbergh and Henry Ford were the two probably most outspoken anti-war activists. They would travel around the country, gave these massive speeches about how America has to stay out of this war. Now, after Pearl Harbor, these guys, in the end, they were patriots. They didn't want us to stay out of the war because, you know, they didn't like America. They loved America. But once the war started, once we were attacked, they got on the bandwagon and wanted to do their part to save the world. Now, Lindbergh was so outspoken against the war and such an enemy of FDR that he couldn't get a job. Nobody would hire him. Even though we were desperate for airplane engineers and trained pilots, the most famous pilot in the world couldn't get a job. Isn't that amazing? So the only person who was brave enough to hire him was this iconoclast, Henry Ford. So Henry Ford hired Lindbergh, and Lindbergh and Henry Ford and Edsel Ford and another character named Charlie Sorensen, they're the main figures behind building the Willow Run Bomber Factory.
So what impact did this have on the city of Detroit around, say, 1943? This must have been a major impact to the city.
Well, the entire economy changed. All businesses that didn't serve the war effort, many of them closed. And I have facts and figures in the book explaining how that happened. And a lot of people, I mean, hundreds and hundreds of thousands of people moved out of the state where they lived to find some job, you know, coming out of the Great Depression, where there were so many people who were helpless and didn't have money and didn't have jobs. Suddenly there were jobs everywhere. And so these people, a lot of people moved to where the money was. And Detroit was where the money was, because that's where so much of the war manufacturing was happening. Massive new factories were going up that didn't exist before, like the Chrysler tank, the Detroit tank arsenal, where Chrysler built as many tanks as all of Nazi Germany built during the war in this one factory in Michigan. So hundreds of thousands of people are pouring into the Detroit area for these jobs. And one of the things that in the middle of the book that happens is the Detroit race riot in 1943, because you had people getting, you know, crowded into the city. And, you know, deprived of things like coffee and beer and sugar, and it just, the whole situation just exploded. So there was a riot, black against white, went on for days. And again, I was able to describe the riot, Detroit race riot in 1943 in great detail, using all sorts of sources that I was able to find, oral histories and, of course, newspapers at the time and pictures, and it was quite a terrible event.
Did the problem here in race relations spill over to the Ford production line as they're trying to get these planes off the line and into the war?
Absolutely. And this is something that really terrified management. So, you know, you have to imagine the amount of stress in these workplaces, because not only did you have company management against labor, right? So the unions against Harry Bennett's service department that I talked about before, the largest private police force in the country. So you had labor against this police force. and the stress and potential violence in the factories because of that. Then you've got blacks versus white and the potential violence because of that. And then you have hundreds of thousands, you have all of these women working on assembly lines where they didn't before. And you think about that, and you think they didn't build these factories with men's and women's bathrooms because there were no women until the war. So it's just one example of ways that these factories were extraordinary, stressful places to be.
You're listening to Reader's Corner, and I'm talking today with A.J. Bamey, author of the book Arsenal of Democracy, FDR, Detroit, and an Epic Quest to Arm an America at War. So let's get to the heart of the matter, so to speak. First of all, tell us how many B-24s were produced in this period of time as we prepared for the war, and then I want you to talk about Operation Tidal Wave.
Well, in the end, 18,482 B-24 Liberators were built. These things weighed 60,000 pounds fully loaded, right? 18,482 were built. The Fords built 8,685 of them. There were, I believe, four other companies. So five companies, I think. Either four or five were building the Liberator. Ford built way more than anybody else. 8,685 60,000-pound bombers in this one factory. There was a total of 80,774 workers who worked at the bomber plant through the war. 61% were men, 39% women. And the cost to make a Liberator was $238,000 per ship at the beginning. And at the end, it was $137,000 per ship. That's quite impressive. Right. The Fords also built 57,851 aviation engines, these massive double-wasp radial engines, huge engines. Let's see. Almost 278,000 Jeeps, over 93,000 trucks, almost 27,000 tank engines, over 2,700 tanks, well over 4,000 invasion gliders that were used during the D-Day invasion. So almost $5 billion worth of war products in 1945 dollars. That's quite a bit. Now, you asked about Operation Tidal Wave. I wanted there to be in the book not just what happens on the assembly lines, but I wanted the reader to get an experience of what it was like to be in these airplanes after they were built. So I wrote about Operation Tidal Wave, which was the first big-time military operation using the B-24, where we went in and tried to blow up Hitler's major source of oil. Because we thought that, you know, if the war was a contest of mass production, and if the war was about mounting power on wings and wheels, if we could destroy Hitler's source of oil, that would do a lot to win the war. The operation went very, very poorly. We sent in these bombers. We thought that if we sent them in literally at treetop level, they're literally, you could almost reach up and touch them. These things are, you know, attacking at 250 miles an hour, 60,000-pound ships. If we sent them in that low, we would avoid radar. So that's what we did. But it didn't work out. It was a pretty ugly operation. We lost a lot of men and a lot of ships. That I wanted to describe in great detail, so I was able to find oral histories, explanations of what happened through the eyes of the guys who survived that mission, attacking the most highly fortified oil base in the world.
My recollection is that over 400 airmen were either killed or missing, but then they went back for a second run. The second one, was that a little bit more successful? Didn't they go back a second time to do this?
Was it ever? Yeah. So Operation Tidal Wave was in 1943, and in 1944, we'd figured out a lot. We'd learned from our mistakes, and we sent massive, massive wings of bombers in there and destroyed Hitler's source of oil. And we did that just before D-Day and during D-Day to make sure that we were going to stem any sort of pretty much anything that Hitler could do. We also blew up all of the railroads. But it's really brilliant. You know, if you destroy all the railroad tracks, how are they going to move stuff around? So we had great strategists on our side.
I really enjoyed the part of your book. I mean, maybe enjoy is the wrong word because there wasn't too much enjoyable about it, I guess. But where you describe these young men who are in Libya, these flyers, getting ready for battle, getting ready to fly these planes across the Mediterranean and into Romania, and they're instructed to sit down and write a letter to their loved ones. That may be the last communication they ever have with them. And, you know, with over 400 of them missing or killed, that was exactly the case. Again, just something we can't begin to understand the enormity of in this day and age.
No, I mean, these guys, they knew that there was a good chance that they were all going to die. And they had figured out before they flew this mission that their lives were worth the results. And so they were set. They had to sit down. For the preparations for the mission were fascinating. That the military used movie cameras, and they constructed out of cardboard a small model of what the oil refineries looked like, what these flyers would see. And then they mounted camera on a chair with wheels and moved it around and made a video. And they had never done this before, to show these flyers, to train them. And so the night before, these guys all sat down to write a letter. And if they didn't return, these letters would go out as a farewell to their loved ones. Can you imagine being in that position today? It's just hard to fathom.
Yeah. There were some pretty famous names you mentioned who actually flew these B-24s. You want to rattle off a couple of them?
Well, Jimmy Stewart is my favorite. Jimmy Stewart's in there, right?
Yeah.
Jimmy Stewart in there. He was a great pilot. You don't think like, wow, Jimmy Stewart, he was a real war hero, and he was. He was a great pilot.
So when you get to the toward the end of your book, you switch back to the Ford family after D-Day is this decisive victory, and you talk about the succession management plan, or lack thereof, as far as the Fords are concerned. But Henry did actually have something in his will, I think, to deal with that. How does this all play out? What's first of all, what's the issue regarding succession, and then how is it resolved?
The book, The Arsenal of Democracy, it goes, there are two sort of plots happening at the same time. There's this internecine battle between power struggle within the Ford family for the future of this company. Again, one of the most famous companies, possibly the most famous company in the world. And through this bizarre series of circumstances, after Edsel Ford dies in 1943, it appears that this company is going to fall into the hands of this man named Harry Bennett, who is literally a gangster. The Ford empire, this massive, hugely famous empire, was going to fall into the hands of a gangster. Can you imagine? And so Edsel's son, Henry Ford II, has to come back to Dearborn. He's discharged honorably from the Navy, and he has to go back and wrestle this empire away from his, basically his grandfather, who's sort of lost it by this time. He's suffering from dementia. And this company is going to fall into the hands of a gangster, and Henry Ford II has to come back and save the company and honor his father's name, and that's what happens. So right after the D-Day invasion and right when the war is ending, this battle for this empire is happening at the same time as the Fords are building these bombers that are going over and bombing the heck out of Germany and Japan. And so the climactic battles of both wars, if you will, happen at the same time. So as a writer, it's always fun to tell stories that fall into a perfect narrative arc, and that's what happened here.
So let's bring the story up to current times. After years of really tough competition from abroad, the Ford Motor Company came back, and they did so, as I remember it, without the government bailouts that GM accepted. Is there something about Ford's corporate or family culture that you learned in this book that is in any way responsible for the culture today and the success they've had just recently and the continuing success of the Ford Motor Company?
I think so, absolutely. I encourage people to read a book by Bryce Hoffman. He's a wonderful writer, Detroit-based writer, who wrote a book about exactly what you're talking about. The company and the empire during the Great Recession and what happened and again, a power struggle and what the culture was like. And it's really interesting read. And it goes as a nice companion piece to my book. They go well together because one is about this empire in the early part of the century and during the war, and his is about the empire in the last 10 years. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I'm a Ford fan. I bleed Ford blue, as they say. And the family's story, you just can't believe it. It's true. You can't believe that this is not fiction, that all of these incredible chapters happen in this one family empire. It's just unbelievable.
Well, AJ, we've run out of time, but I want to thank you for coming on Reader's Corner. This is a great read. Again, the name of the book, The Arsenal of Democracy, FDR Detroit, and an Epic Quest to Arm an America at War. Thank you so much for joining us, AJ Bamey.
Thank you so much.
I hope you enjoyed this encore edition of our interview with A.J. Bamey. Next week, National Book Award winner Timothy Egan, author of a new bestseller, The Immortal Irishman, the Irish revolutionary who became an American hero. Reader's Corner is presented by Boise State Public Radio. The engineer for today's show is Eric Jones. Research by Sienna Madrid. Our producer is Janelle Brown. I'm Bob Custra. Please join me next week as we talk to today's leading writers about the ideas and issues that help shape our world at Reader's Corner. You can find out what's coming up next on our program and listen online at our website. That's BoiseStatePublicRadio.org.